in this computer. Thank you for that. That was very helpful. Okay. It is July 14th, Tuesday morning, 10:26 now, Chem 3, and we're going to do an acid-base introduction. And Karina was very helpful in making sure that I got that recording on there. So awesome. Kudos. Thank you, Karina. When we have looked at ions, what we have looked at is the trading back and forth of electrons. In acid base, what we look at is we look at trading back and forth of protons. So acid base is all about a proton. And what do we think about a proton? What is a proton? A proton, when we think about it, is that positively charged particle. If we look at a hydrogen ion, the hydrogen ion is actually one proton and zero electrons. In essence, it actually is just a proton. And so we use the word proton and hydrogen ion interchangeably. So those two terms we kind of throw back and forth, and they mean H plus. The definition of an acid and base, there are three different definitions. There is an Arrhenius definition, a very early definition. There's a Bronsted-Lowry definition. And then there's a Lewis definition for acids and bases. We tend to stick with the Arrhenius and the Bronsted-Lowry definitions. So let me give those two. We'll look at those two. Three definitions of acid and base. The three definitions happen because each definition is more inclusive, broadens the scope out of what we think of an acid and what we think of as a base. The original definitions, the Arrhenius definitions, I'm never going to spell Arrhenius correctly, but I'm sitting in front of a computer and that means that I can Google Arrhenius. There you go. Arrhenius. The Arrhenius definition of acid and base was a very simple definition. And what it said was, that an acid produced hydronium in water. Or actually put the word in there, produced hydronium when placed in water. So what is hydronium ion? Hydronium ion, if I take a proton and I add it to water, and I'll do it by Lewis structure, what I get is I get a water molecule that has three hydrogens on it. And the whole molecule has a positive charge. Formally, the positive charge resides on the oxygen, but in our true Lewis structure sense, instead of doing formal charges, we'll do it this way. This is hydronium ion. And so when I take an acid and put an acid into water, it produces hydronium, or I get hydronium. A base, when placed into water, produced hydroxide ion. When placed in water. And hydroxide ion, we know what the structure of hydroxide ion is because that's one of our polyatomics that we need to work with. Hydronium was one of our polyatomics too, but we think of it we think of it as H3O plus, and that's hydronium. So different ways of writing the hydronium ion. And the key thing here with Arrhenius is that what Arrhenius was doing in these very early days of chemistry was he was looking at how it reacted in water. But not everything that is an acid reacts in water. Or I should say that there are acids, and we can identify acids outside of water. And so the Bronsted-Lowry definition allowed us to change the focus from water and having to compare everything to water to a definition that took water out of the equation. So Bronsted-Lowry were a team of people, two people, Bronsted and Lowry. And their definition of acid was that an acid is a hydrogen ion donor. And a base is the opposite. A base is a hydrogen ion acceptor. So in this sense, if we think about an acid as having a proton, and this piece here being the proton, and let's change this to reflect that this is an acid, and the acid has the proton, and this is the base, then what happens is the base takes the proton, and the line represents a lone pair of electrons. Let's give this guy a lone pair of electrons here. How they act as donor and acceptor define what an acid and a base is. And it is nothing more than one giving up a proton and the other accepting. Anything that accepts a proton is called a base, and anything that donates a proton is called an acid. Well, how does this fit with the Arrhenius definition? If we think about this in the Arrhenius definition, if I had an acid in the Arrhenius definition, here was my acid with its proton, and here's a water molecule. In the Arrhenius definition, when the water molecule takes the proton, we can see how the acid functioned to actually produce hydronium. Because what wound up happening is the acid donated the hydrogen ion to the water molecule to produce hydronium. And so in the Arrhenius definition, the Bronsted-Lowry encompasses the Arrhenius definition. It's broader than the Arrhenius definition. It's easier to use than the Arrhenius definition. And in the Arrhenius definition, remember that a base was something that produced hydroxide in water. Well, how did that happen? If we look at a base having a lone pair of electrons and taking away a proton from a water molecule, then we can see that base picking up that proton and producing hydroxide ion. In water. And so the base there, in that sense, here's our proton that we're picking up. The base produces hydroxide ion in water. And again, this definition, so H isn't acid minus H. No, it's a dash. It's a bond to the proton. So the dash is not, the dash is a chemical bond with two electrons in that chemical bond. Yes, Kai, thank you. That's good clarification. That what we're looking at is a chemical bond between the acid and the proton. So I can give you some examples. So let's look at some examples here. Some actual chemical examples rather than the definitions that I'm drawing. For instance, one of the acids that we can look at that you guys named earlier was acetic acid. We'll do it by Lewis structure again. So now the bond looks more familiar in a familiar setting, and the water molecule can take the proton, we'll label the acidic proton. The water molecule can use its lone pairs of electrons to take that proton, giving the electrons back to the acid. And the water accepting that proton now becomes the hydronium ion. And this guy picks up a negative charge. A base could be considered to be, I'm trying to think of a good base to use that is not a hydroxide base. Let's use ammonia. Reacting with water. In this sense, it can take the proton, giving the electrons back to the water. The ammonia becomes ammonium ion, and the hydroxide is the result. And that has a negative charge on it. So to label these, I'm going to move this down just a little bit, and we can label this is acetic acid, and it is the proton donor. Water here is acting as a base and is the proton acceptor. And we produced hydronium. And we produced acetate. Down here, we used ammonia and water. In this case, water acts as the acid. It is the proton donor, and ammonia is acting as the base, the proton acceptor. They produce ammonium ion and hydroxide ion. Well, let me ask you this. Look at this. Look at water that is here. This is water acting as a base. Water is accepting the proton as a proton acceptor. This is water acting as a proton donor. It is giving up the proton. And in giving up the proton, it's acting as an acid. Water can act either as a base or an acid. It acts as both. And there are many different compounds that have that ability to be able to act as acids or as water, as base, depending upon what it is they're acting with. There's a specific term for that. We call it amphoteric. Amphoteric is a species that can act as an acid or a base, depending on what it is acting with. So that's the word amphoteric. Okay, so we have this idea of something acting as an acid and a base. Let me give you another idea. Let's take a look at this reaction in a little more detail. Let's pick Well, let's stick with the acetic acid. I was trying to pick a different acid, mainly because I didn't want to have you guys draw so much with the notes, but this will work. I want to go back and look at this definition again. And I want to highlight another aspect of this definition. If we take acetic acid and we react it with water, this reaction is actually reversible. We haven't talked about reversible reactions yet. But when we take that proton and we give the electrons back to the acetic acid and we produce acetate ion, and that has a negative charge on it, and we produce hydronium, and hydronium has a positive charge. There's a couple of aspects that I want to talk about here. Number one, on the left-hand side of this equation, notice that everything is neutral, that there are no charges on acetic acid and no charges on water. And yet, when I give up that proton, I give away a hydrogen ion. Picking up one more proton, the water incurs a positive charge. Giving up the proton, the acetate gets a negative charge. The positive and negative cancel each other out such that the net charge is zero, and the net charge on the left-hand side are zero. The net charge in a chemical reaction needs to remain the same. The net charge cannot change from the left-hand side to the right-hand side. So whatever the net charge is over here, it will also be the same on the product side. Now, we said that this was the acid because it was the proton donor. And the base and the water is the base because it is the hydrogen ion or proton acceptor. If I run this reaction in reverse, think about the reverse reaction. The reverse reaction is that the acetate takes the proton and hydronium does the donating. So on this side, I could say that this is the acid and is the proton donor, and this one, the base, and is the proton acceptor. When something acts as an acid and it gives away a proton, once it gives away the proton, it turns into something that can take the proton back. It essentially has an empty hand. If we think about these electrons right here, it's too big a highlighter. Let's do it with a small highlighter. If I think about these electrons here, that's those two electrons that we're looking at, and these two electrons in that bond. And essentially, when something gives up, that was the wrong bond I highlighted. You guys didn't stop me. I got to go all the way back and highlight that bond. And these electrons, that bond was the right bond, so that was okay. When this guy gave up the proton, it acted as an acid. In doing so, it gained two lone pairs, which constitute a negative charge, and that means that it can take the proton back at some point in time. And in taking it back, it can become an acceptor, which means that it is a base. Essentially, these two species are linked together in a relationship, as are the water and the hydronium. They are linked together in a relationship as well. The relationship is one that is called conjugates. A conjugate, the definition, are two compounds A relationship between two compounds that differ by one proton. So an acid, by example, and the proton that I'm looking at, so this is my acid, and the acetate are said to be conjugates of one another, because they differ in their formula by one proton. And these are said to be conjugates. And one of the pair is an acid, and the other of the pair is a base.
How do those differ by one proton? I don't understand.
Can you see that this one has the proton and this one does not?
Oh, okay. Yep.
So that by formula, this is HC2H3O2, and this one is C2H3O2-. It's missing that proton in the right-hand formula. And so these are conjugates. Hydronium and water are also conjugates, differing by the one proton.
Is that why you write it like that, with the fourth H in front, so it differentiates?
Yes, because we always write the acidic proton, however many there are, the acidic proton is always written in the front on the left-hand side. It is the way that we designate an acid, is by writing that acidic proton, or however many acidic protons there are, on the left-hand side. It's what designates an acid. Okay? So this idea of conjugates, what acts as an acid becomes a base, its conjugate base. And what acts as a base becomes its conjugate acid. And they always come in pairs, acids and bases, in this way.
The H is the thing that makes a difference. Is that what you just said?
The H is the thing that makes a difference. Yes, the H is what makes it an acid, or in accepting that H, what makes it a base. So this idea of acting as an acid and acting as a base comes from its behavior, comes from how it actually functions. Along with this, we have different strengths of acids and bases. In the strength of acid, we have what we call a strong acid. A strong acid, the definition of a strong acid, is that it ionizes completely when placed in water. Or let's use the word dissociates, because we understand that word better. So dissociates completely. What do I mean? Let's take a strong acid like HCl, and we will place it into water, and we look at the creation of the chloride ion and hydronium, H3O plus. And so now I've switched from a Lewis structure form to writing it more in a chemical formula type sense. And by dissociates completely, what we mean is that almost all of the mass in this equation, if I had 100 molecules, and 100 molecules, then I would have to start with, so this is what I was starting with. When the reaction was done, in order for this to make sense, And initially I had 0 and 0. When the reaction is done, what I have left is maybe one molecule. And on the right-hand side, 99 and 99. So we can think of this sort of like an initial and then a final. And I guess my balance really belongs on my final to show where the mass balance is. So this balance really belongs down here in this picture. I know I'm constructing an image here and sort of getting what I want. So initially, and then after reaction. That picture. And so by ionizing completely, what we're saying is that all of this material shifts and becomes chloride and hydronium, and that it ionizes or dissociates completely when placed into water. That's the definition of a strong acid. A weak acid, what is a weak acid then? A weak acid is different than this. So here's the definition of a weak acid. A weak acid dissociates only a little. When placed into water. An example of a weak acid before and after. The acetic acid is actually a weak acid. Even though we started our definition with this. And when this reacts with water, let's do it in a chemical formula sense rather than a Lewis structure. It produces the acetate anion. And hydronium. And if I started with 100 molecules and 100 molecules, after the reaction is over, so this is my initial, and my after the reaction. What I would have, oh, and I had 0 initially, I might have something like, 85 and 85 and 15 molecules and 15 molecules. And that we say that the mass balance on this one is on that side, on the reactant side. And so it does not dissociate completely. It only dissociates a little. And in order to demonstrate that, we use different arrows to demonstrate that. We use one-way arrows to demonstrate something that ionizes completely. And we use a two-way arrow, what's called an equilibrium arrow, to demonstrate something that ionizes or dissociates only partway. So the difference really is in how we draw it in terms of the types of arrows that we use. And it's really about the mass balance. It's really about the starting materials ionizing completely and forming products versus those starting materials only giving just a little bit of those products and most of it being unreacted. And that's really the difference between a strong acid and a weak acid. And what you could say is that all of the acid that is a strong acid, when you put it into water, it gives you the same amount of hydronium as the amount of acid that you started with. But when you put a weak acid into water, it gives you only a little bit of hydronium, a little bit of acid. And that's the difference between a strong and a weak in the terms, in the way that we define acids, so that the strength of the acid. There's something else that I was going to go over this. Oh, yes. A list of strong acids. Which acids are strong? Which acids are weak? Strong acids. HCl. HNO3. And H2SO4. These are considered to be strong acids, and they're generally the three that we cite as being the strong acids. This is hydrochloric. Nitric. And sulfuric. There are other strong acids. There are many, many other strong acids. These are the three that we generally memorize. Also strong, also kind of in this list, are HBr and HI. The halogens. So we think hydrobromic and hydroiodic. For weak acids, a weak acid is pretty much everything not on the strong acid list. So giving you a list of weak acids is a little bit more difficult because there are many, many, many. For example, acetate, H2H3O2, acetic acid. There was H2C2O2, oxalic acid. Anything not on the strong acid list is considered to be a weak acid. So there's too many to be able to list out to show you. Okay, if that's a strong acid and a weak acid, what about a strong base and a weak base? This concept of dissociates completely in terms of the strength of acid. So when we say that a strong acid dissociates completely in place in water and a weak dissociates only a little in water, that definition works for bases as well. It is the exact same concept, and we use dissociation in order to be able to tell what is a strong and what is a weak base. So the strong and weak base strength of base, strong base. Dissociates completely in water. These are generally metal hydroxides. Generally group 1A metal hydroxides. And now that we've gone through solubility, you can tell me why the group 1A's metal hydroxides would be something that dissociates completely. Because dissociation is about dissolving for ionic compounds. I need to get the highlighter back into, there we go.
Is so dissociation when, the opposite of precipitation?
Yes, it is. Yes, dissociation is actually the opposite of precipitation. Yes, for ionic compounds, that is true. And so here, if I have a metal hydroxide, something like sodium hydroxide, and I take this as a solid and I place it into water, then what it forms is NaOH aqueous, and it dissolves entirely. Another way to think about this is to think about this as being Na plus aqueous and hydroxide minus aqueous. So these metal hydroxides, when they dissolve into water, they dissolve completely, and there's very little of that solid left over. A weak base is something that only dissociates a little.
So in these formulas, is the water acting as the acid?
In essence, yes. But more than that, we're sort of still using almost an Arrhenius definition that when I take a base and put a base into water, it liberates hydroxide or makes hydroxide. In essence, when I take sodium hydroxide and place it into water, yes, the water is acting as an acid, but more than that, I'm actually just increasing the amount of hydroxide that is in the solution, and the hydroxide literally is the base. It is the proton acceptor. And so we could say that water is the proton donor, but generally when I have a lot of hydroxide, I oftentimes look at using a different proton donor than water in the way that it reacts as an acid and a base. So we treat bases a little different than we treat acids. And a weak base, as I said, dissociates a little bit in water. A weak base, if I take and look at it like this way, I'm trying to think which weak base I want to use. Let's use ammonia as a weak base. Ammonia, when placed into water, produces ammonium ion and hydroxide ion. So the dissociation, this one's not quite, I should like maybe change this word.
Question.
I'm going to use this word with caution, because usually dissociates also means ionizes. And as ionizes, we're saying produces ions. And so dissociates usually means ionizes, usually means to produce ions. And in this sense, when we have added ammonia into water, to produce ammonium, it does so with that sort of equilibrium arrow and with an equilibrium that says that the left-hand side is the majority of the side, the right-hand side, there's very little of this. So we make few ions, mostly molecular.
Quick question.
Yes.
Plus H2O, that's saying added into water.
That's right.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. And I'm purposefully doing them in a different way. I'm purposefully putting the water over the arrow over here Because if I say sodium hydroxide plus water, it gets very confusing when I write the product. So I like to, before I even try to do that, what happens if I take sodium hydroxide and I say plus water? Water doesn't really react with it. What I get is I get sodium hydroxide aqueous plus water. The water doesn't really do anything other than cause the dissociation of the sodium hydroxide. And so writing it this way can be confusing. And so we tend not to write it this way because of the confusion that it creates. And what is the water actually doing when I do this? And so instead we write sodium hydroxide as a solid and put the water over the arrow more like a catalyst and say that it is allowing for the dissociation of the sodium hydroxide, but doesn't technically react with it. So the water is not really acting as an acid or a base. It is just the medium in which the sodium hydroxide is dissociating into sodium ions and hydroxide ions. And so that is an important component in the way that we think about hydroxide.
Is there a way to know how a molecule would react in water? Like if it would dissociate completely? Like, do we just have to know what it does? Or is there a way to kind of see it, just looking at it?
It's a really good question. And the answer to it is that for now, it becomes a memorization component. It's seeing it, it's recognizing it. There's nothing easy that I can point to tell you how something is going to behave when it's placed into water. So we can't just look at a compound and know whether a compound is going to be an acid or a base. And in fact, there's a lab that we do. You're bringing up a really good question. There's a lab that we do that is a lab experiment. And what we do is we use a number of different indicators. And the indicators are used in combination with it's actually two different labs that we use. So one is a color indicator. Bromothymol blue is the indicator. And that indicator, when the solution is neutral, and there is no acid or base, and then when I have acid present, and when I have base present, under acidic conditions, the bromothymol blue turns yellow. That is going to be really hard to see, so I'm going to do it this way. Under acidic conditions, the bromothymol blue turns yellow. And under basic conditions, it turns blue. And under neutral conditions, when it starts off, if you take yellow and blue and you mix them, what you get is green, although that didn't really mix well. I wonder if I mix it the other way. I expected the colors to try to mix, but they did not do what I expected them to do. No, it still doesn't do it. But I can put green in the center and we can kind of make it green. This is green to start off with. What we do is we take the bromothymol blue and we add the different reagents to it and we see whether it turns yellow or whether it turns blue. And we can tell whether or not the reagent is an acid or a base based on whether it's turning green, yellow or blue. The other tool that we have is a little tool that is a little circuit board. And the circuit board has two electrodes that come off the circuit board. And there's a battery that hooks to this, a 9-volt battery. and then a couple of leads that take that down to the circuit board. And also on the circuit board is a little diode. And the diode lights up if there is ions in solution. So when we take this and we touch this to a droplet, if there are ions in the droplet, then electricity will be allowed to flow between the positive cathode and the negative anode, and it will complete the circuit and the light will shine. And based on how many ions there are in solution, the light will be very bright versus very few ions, the light will be dim. And so we can measure sort of the conductive nature of how many ions are in solution. And so if the light is bright, it means that there are many ions in solution. Implying strong. And if the light is dim or off, then that is implying very few ions in solution. And that is implying weak. Between the two experiments, we can decide whether a reagent is an acid or a base, and whether it's strong or weak by comparing them and looking at how many ions are formed in solution and what color. So for instance, if I take a reagent that I have no idea whether it's an acid or a base, and let's say that we want to test HSO4, and this is sodium bisulfate. What I find is that when I put this into solution, that the BTB turns green. Actually turns yellow. And that implies that this is an acid.
What's BTB?
BTB, oh, I didn't do it. BTB, bromothymol blue. It's the abbreviation, because that word is so long, or that name is so long to write on the pipette, that we don't tend to use the entire name. We tend to use the abbreviation BTB. And so the indicator BTB turns yellow, indicating that this thing is an acid. And yet others, for instance, if I do sodium, it's sodium hydrogen phosphate. That's what I want. PO4, sodium hydrogen phosphate. The BTB turns blue, and this is a base. And if you look at these, the sodium is the spectator ion, and what we're saying is that HSO4 minus is an acid, and HPO4 2 minus is a base, and yet they both have a proton and they have similar sorts of structures, and there's no way to tell by looking at them whether one is an acid or one is a base. You can only tell by experiment. So I'm not trying to make sense out of it. I'm actually showing you that you cannot tell just by looking. That it's actually an excellent question, that by looking at it, we can't recognize acid or base. Only in through experimentation can we decide whether some of these are acids or bases.
Is testing for an acid the same as testing the pH?
Yes, in essence, pH is another way of testing. And let me finish this thought here. Only by testing can we tell acid from base for many different things. There are other ways, and there are ways that I can recognize a definite acid. There are ways that I can recognize a definite base, but many of them must be tested in order to be able to tell whether it's an acid or a base. So some of those, for instance, when I look at H3PO4, or H2SO4. This is phosphoric acid. And sulfuric acid. And by looking at it, there's no charges, there's no metals. Oh, that is not what I wanted to do. There's no charges or metals. These things are, by virtue of their name, they are definitely acids by virtue of their name. And they are acids. Hydroxides, sodium hydroxide, potassium hydroxide, these things, by virtue of having the hydroxide in them, are bases. So sodium hydroxide and potassium hydroxide are bases. So some of them we can definitely recognize just by looking at them and knowing whether they're an acid or base. But many of these that are the polyatomic ions with sodium or potassium or other metals, you can't tell by looking at them whether they're acids or bases. You have to test them in order to be able to figure that out. So the answer partially is yes for some, no for others. Sorry, that's the way it is. pH. What time is it? We got to take a break in a minute. Well, we can finish pH. We can't finish pH. We can say what pH is. pH is a measurement of the amount of hydrogen ion . And when we think about hydrogen ion is synonymous with hydronium. Because the hydrogen ion doesn't exist in water by itself. The hydrogen ion, I think of like a flea and a dog, the water molecule being the dog, that the hydrogen ion jumps from water molecule to water molecule to water molecule, never really existing on its own. The hydrogen ion is always associated with a water molecule. And so I use the two interchangeably, hydrogen ion and hydronium. So when I measure the amount of hydrogen ion, I'm also measuring the amount of hydronium. But it's stated to be the amount of hydrogen ion in solution. And it technically is pH equals minus the log, logarithmic base 10, of the hydrogen ion concentration in moles per liter. So the square brackets equal concentration measured in moles per liter of solution. So that's saying that that is also equal to minus the log of the hydronium ion concentration in solution. They are one and the same. And because it's a logarithmic scale, they are powers of 10. And the scale runs and keeps going. But 7, we say, is neutral. 0, but there are negative values, so we can keep going to negative values. 0 is acidic. And up to 14, this is basic. But there are higher values. Values above 14. So we can go greater than 14. What I was doing there was fine. So values can go greater than 14. This is what we call the pH scale. And in order to interpret that, what we're saying is that the hydrogen ion concentration is equal to 10 to the 7th power in moles per liter. Or out here, the hydrogen ion concentration is equal to 10 to the, oh, it's minus 7, to the minus 14th in moles per liter. And over here, the hydrogen ion concentration is equal to 10 to the minus 0 moles per liter. And that in general, the hydrogen ion concentration is equal to 10 to the minus pH moles per liter. So pH is just a way of taking really big numbers and really small numbers and converting them into a logarithm that gives me values between 0 and 14, which are easy to manage. And it is a measure of whether something is an acid or a base, because I can look at the pH and I can say anything greater than 7 is a base and anything less than 7 is an acid. And so, yes, that's exactly what pH is. And we, in the next chapter, not the next chapter, I think it's, I don't know which chapter it is. In the acid-base chapter, we learn all about calculating pH, and we'll do a lot of problems with calculating pH. And that's a main part of what that acid-base chapter is working with pH and going through and looking at calculations of how do I calculate how strong an acid is or how weak an acid is or a base and all of that stuff. So those are all great things to look at. Yeah.
Could you refresh us on what a log is?
Oh, maybe. Okay, logarithm. When I say the log of X, I'm saying what power do I need to raise 10 to in order to equal X? So the log of 3 says, what power do I need to raise 10 to in order for it to be equal to 3? It is a mathematical conversion of taking and figuring out the exponent that I raise 10 to in order to equal the value of the thing that I'm taking the log of. And so there's no way to do that without a calculator or a table. You need to either have a calculator or a table, because it's not like multiplication and it's not like addition or subtraction. So we need either a table of logarithms or we need the calculator to be able to actually do that function. Okay. And the difference between the log and the natural log, ln, is the natural log. And in that, we use a base e. E is a value that is 2 point something. And so when we take the natural log of 3, it says, what power do I need to raise the base e to in order to equal 3? So the logarithm is specifically base 10. Whereas the natural log is e. They're the same sort of function, just with a different base. Felt like that was important to add in there, so we understood the difference between them. So don't use natural log on mistake. Use the log, L-O-G, base 10. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll figure out where to go from here. Can I scroll up? Yes. Weak acids, weak base. How far up? To the strong acid and weak acid? All the way up here, the list. I feel like I kind of want to go all the way there.
Yeah, the one where it says, oh yeah, that's perfect. Thank you.
Okay. All right, so I'm going to guess that you may be taking a screenshot or you're writing down some things. As soon as I stop the screen share to put music on, we're going to lose that picture. So, Karina, are you okay? You got what you need?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. Thank you.
All right, going for music. Here we go. If I can figure this out, maybe I can figure this out. You'd think I'd be good at this already. There's so many buttons to push. To make it do what you want. God, I'm ultimately failing here. Success. We're going to write a song now. That's better.
Comes a little death. magic again. Bada bing, bada boom. Bada bing, bada boom. Every time my baby's in my room. Bada bing, bada boom. Bada bing, bada boom. I'm crazy, crazy for you. Bing, bada bing, bada bing, bada bing. Bing, bada bing, bada boom. La, 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 la.
Bada bing, bada boom, bada boom, boom, boom.
Bada bing, bada boom, bada bing, bada boom. Every time my baby's in my room. Bada bing, bada boom, bada bing, bada boom. I'm crazy, crazy for you. Bing, bada bing, bada bing, bada bing, bing, bada bing, bada boom, boom, boom.
Bada bing, bada boom, bada bing, bada boom.
If I had way. Just to keep you from walking away. Let your friends laugh. Even this I can stand.
The night got me thinking, what is it with him? He's naturally moving slow. I see him at the corner bar. Am I dreaming? Surrounded by friends, it's got to end. I need to know. Am I just a night of lust, a lost temptation? Is someone like me his destiny? He'll never know.
Okay, coming back. Screen share's off. Put this one back on. All right, so we went a little farther than I wanted to in terms of pH, but we had the question, so I felt like I needed to address pH there, which is good. We'll see it initially here, and then we'll deal with it a little bit later in other chapters. One of the things that I did say that I haven't covered yet is that acid-base reactions follow the double displacement pattern. And we need to show how that works. So it's the double displacement or double replacement. And in doing that, let's remind ourselves what that pattern is. It's AB plus CD goes to form AD plus CB. That we're taking cation and anion, cation and anion, and we're swapping partners. A goes with D, C goes with B. And the acid base follows this general pattern. So if I take sodium hydroxide, for instance, a base, and I react it with an acid, HCl. We treat the proton like a cation, and the sodium goes with the chloride, and the hydrogen goes with the hydroxide, and what we produce is sodium chloride and HOH, which we group together and write as H2O and water. So in essence, they do follow the double displacement pattern. It's just that we don't see it that way exactly when we write it out as an equation. Sodium hydroxide plus HCl goes to form sodium chloride and water, H2O. And it is exactly the double displacement pattern. But we call this something else, actually, besides just double displacement pattern. We give this a specific type of name. We call it a neutralization reaction. And we can look at why we call it that. This is a neutralization reaction. And a neutralization reaction is the reaction between an acid and a base. And they always produce similar products, not identical products. We say they produce the same products, but what we really mean is similar products. What they produce, it's the reaction between an acid and a base to produce a salt and water. So when we take the base, sodium hydroxide, and HCl, the acid, and we react them together, we get NaCl, sodium chloride, which literally is table salt, by the way, and water. Now we said a salt, which means that this is an ionic compound. It's not always sodium chloride. It is many different ionic compounds that can be produced based on the difference of the acid and the base, but I produce a salt and water. An ionic compound and water are what are produced in a neutralization reaction. So I could take sodium hydroxide and react it with H2SO4 following the double displacement pattern. I have sodium, the cation, hydroxide, the anion, hydrogen, the cation, and sulfate, 2-, the anion. So if I think about this in a balancing terms of cation and anion, and I'm going to take and I'm going to swap the sodium with the sulfate and the hydrogen with the hydroxide, I'm going to make sodium sulfate. And that means I will need two sodiums to match the sulfate, to match the charges, 2- to 2+. And when I bring together hydroxide and water and hydrogen to make water, the hydrogen is a single plus, hydroxide a single minus. And as I bring them together, they come together 1-to-1. And so I make Na2SO4 plus H2O. These are exactly, if you notice, I'm doing the exact same skills I did when we did the double displacement patterns and the balancing of the ionic compounds. So the process is exactly the same. This is my base, sodium hydroxide, my acid, sulfuric acid, my salt, which is my ionic compound, and water. And then once I get that equation, the next step in getting that equation is balancing it. So if I want to balance this equation, I can balance it in a number of different ways. I can balance it in the double displacement pattern, NaOH, H plus, and SO42 minus. But that has complications because when I write H2O, I don't really see it as being hydrogen and hydroxide. So I almost don't recommend doing it this way. I'll show you a way to balance it easier in a minute, but let's take it as sodium, hydrogen, oxygen, and sulfur. There's one sodium. I don't want to shut this thing off. It seemed to have done it itself. There's one sodium, there's three hydrogens, five oxygens, one sulfur.
And why did you cross them out like that?
Because I decided that I was going to confuse you if I tried to do it that way.
Oh, okay.
And I was going to say, don't balance it the way that we do the other double displacements yet. I'm going to show you an easier way to balance these in a minute. I'm going to balance it first the regular way, and then I'll show you an easier way to balance it.
Okay.
Sodium 2. Hydrogen 2, oxygen 5, sulfur 1. Oops, that's supposed to be a 1. And so sodium is out of balance. So we come over here and we throw a 2 coefficient in there. That changes my sodium to 2, changes my oxygen to 2 plus 4 is 6, changes my hydrogen to 2 plus 2 is 4. And that threw hydrogen out of whack, so let's fix that. I need 2 here. That's my second thing. That changes that to 4. Also changes my oxygen to 6, and I'm done. 2, 4, 6, and 1. And my balanced equation is 2 sodium hydroxide plus H2SO4 goes to form Na2SO4 plus 2H2O. Okay, that wasn't too bad, but you want to learn the fast way? Yes, fast way is good. Okay, here's the fast way. Notice that the H2SO4 has 2 hydrogens, and there are 2 hydrogens that are written on the left. Notice the coefficient. The subscript and the coefficient, they're all 2s. Watch this. If I take sodium hydroxide and react it with phosphoric acid, I'm going to make sodium phosphate and water. And I want to balance this. Notice the subscript is a 3. 3, 3, and 3. In balancing these, the subscripts and the coefficients all have to be the same, and they balance super easily. Why is that? Why is that happening? It's happening because if you look at how many hydrogen ions you have 3 hydrogen ions. That means that I need 3 hydroxides in order to react with each of those hydrogens to produce a water molecule, which means that I've produced or needed three of these to react with three of these and produced three waters. And in so doing, I also needed three sodiums to balance the phosphate. That these equations balance really easily. And we talk about the acids in a particular sort of way. HCl is called monoprotic, meaning it has one hydrogen. H2SO4 is called diprotic because it has two hydrogens. H3PO4 is called triprotic because it has three hydrogens. The bases are treated very similarly. Sodium hydroxide can be said to be monobasic because it has one hydroxide. Calcium hydroxide is dibasic because it has two hydroxides. And if I went to ferric hydroxide, this would be tribasic because of the three hydroxides. And so when I'm balancing these equations, I'm really balancing the number of protons against the number of hydroxides to make the appropriate number of waters. And so there are some shortcuts in terms of balancing the sodium hydroxide, but if I'm balancing anything else, for instance, calcium hydroxide, reacting with H2SO4, here I need to be a little bit careful. Here what I have is a dibasic and diprotic. And so they're going to go together, and when they go together, they're going to form two water molecules. Two hydroxides and two hydrogens will form two water molecules. But when I take the calcium and the sulfate and add them together, the calcium is a 2+, and the sulfate is a 2-, and they go together in a 1-to-1 ratio to produce two negatives and two positives. So they are calcium sulfate. Is that sort of making sense? In that here, really I'm being a little bit more careful, but the two is still telling me that I need two waters and that the subscripts are matching. But because I just need to be a little bit careful because the calcium and the sulfate are each a 2+ and 2-, respectively, that I make one calcium sulfate and that balances out the entire thing. So that if I look at it and I go through and I balance it, notice one calcium to one, two hydroxides to two hydrogens to two waters. And so the entire thing does balance. All on its own?
I understand that it's balanced, but I think the first way was a little more easy to comprehend, probably just because it's a familiar process.
I think so too. I think that we could certainly take this if we needed to take calcium hydroxide and balance it with H2SO4 and know that we're doing the double displacement. And so we make calcium sulfate and water is the byproduct that we make. And then we're going to balance this equation with calcium, hydrogen, oxygen, sulfur, that we can certainly do it this way. 4, 2, 6, and 1. So you can always fall back on this. There is nothing wrong with doing it this way. 1, 2, 5, and 1. So I've got to pick up two additional hydrogens. That's my first change. That gives me 2 times that. That gives me total now of 6. Wait, nope, 8. I'm off. and something's wrong. I know what's wrong, I think. I'll recount in a second. What did I count wrong over here? Two times that plus two is four. No, I was okay. And two plus four is six, and I was good. Okay, so two water molecules, two times two is four. So I'm good there. And two oxygens plus another four oxygens is six oxygens. And I'm balanced. One, four, six, and one. So you can always fall back on the standard balancing system, and that always works. Yeah, Eric, you caught it. I was making a mistake, and now I'm back on track. Okay, for acid-base, that's as much as we need to do with acid-base right now. There is a whole lot more to do with acid-base, but it comes later on. Except maybe there's one more thing that we should do here. In the double displacement reactions, we had three different equations that we could write. We had the chemical, we had the ionic, and we had the net ionic. And so for any double displacement reaction, we could write those three ionic or those three equations, chemical, ionic, and net ionic. Since the acid base follows the double displacement pattern, we should be able to do the same thing with acid base. And in fact, it's important to do the same thing with acid base. Watch this, HCl, aqueous, reacting with sodium hydroxide, aqueous, goes to form sodium chloride, aqueous, plus water, which is not aqueous, is a pure material as a liquid. All those things that are aqueous can be dissociated in an ionic equation. So this being the chemical, I can now take and write the ionic, dissociating each of the things that are aqueous. Hydrogen, ion, aqueous, plus chloride, ion, aqueous, plus sodium, ion, aqueous, plus hydroxide, goes to form sodium plus chloride plus water. Because water is a liquid, like solids, I can't dissociate it, I can't break it up. So it stays together. Can you spot the spectators? Can you see that I have sodium on both sides of the equation? And that I also have chloride on both sides of the equation? And so they drop out as spectators. And what drops down is hydrogen, hydroxide, and water. And so the net, ionic is hydrogen ion plus hydroxide ion goes to make water. And we have the three different equations.
Chemistry is hard.
I'm sorry, Jeremy. That was awesome. That was well timed. I have a great story. One of my best friends, he is my best friend, came through my organic chemistry class. And at one point during the class, in just like we were only like 20 minutes into an hour and a half class, he raises his hand and he goes, "My brain's full. Can I go home now?" He was just done. He was flat out done. Chemistry is definitely hard. Yeah, it's pretty funny. So, let's make it interesting and maybe even a little bit easier by doing another example. Oh, could I briefly clarify aqueous and liquid? Yes. Aqueous describes something that is dissolved in water and surrounded by water. So aqueous equals something dissolved in water, specifically water, not some other solvent. And usually it is solvated, for example, the sodium ion surrounded by water molecules. We say that the sodium is aqueous. A liquid is something that just demonstrates the properties of a liquid. It is variable in variable in shape, but fixed in volume. Such that I can take and put it into different shaped containers. And it will change its shape as I put it into those different containers, and yet its volume will be the same. So if I have 100 milliliters, I still have 100 milliliters, but it changes its shape. And this can be multiple materials. For instance, I can have ethanol. I can have water. I could have methanol or toluene, which is airplane model glue, the solvent for airplane model glue. All of these are liquids, but are not dissolved in anything. They're just neat materials, neat meaning nothing else dissolved in them or with them. So we have the difference between a liquid and something that is aqueous. Aqueous is something that is definitely dissolved in water. Okay, I wanted to clarify this. I wanted to do one more of these chemical, ionic, and net ionic. So imprint this in your brain for a second. HCl plus sodium hydroxide forms sodium chloride and water. And when I dissociate it, I keep that thing which is liquid together because it does not dissociate. And the net ionic is hydrogen plus hydroxide makes water. Let's look at the chemical for hydrochloric acid, HCl, reacting with H2SO4. Going to form, no wait, stop, making a mistake. Sodium hydroxide. Reacting with H2SO4, going to make sodium sulfate and water. And I'll balance it just quickly by putting the two coefficients where I need them to be. These are aqueous, 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 and liquid. So I have the chemical equation. Maybe we should label that as chemical. Now let's write the ionic and dissociate it. So that means that I get two sodium ions, charge and state, plus two hydroxides, plus two hydrogen ions, plus one sulfate. So I've broken that up rather quickly. They go to form two sodium ions, plus a sulfate and two water molecules. Can you find the spectators?
SO42 minus, and the 2Na plus.
Right, and the sodium. I'll do them in different colors. So yes, those are my spectators, and everything else drops down. And that becomes the net ionic. So the net ionic is 2 hydroxide plus 2 hydrogen ions goes to form 2 water molecules. And because the coefficients are all 2, I can reduce those coefficients and I can change the order to be a hydrogen ion plus a hydroxide ion goes to make water. Now, wait a second. Notice that we just reacted sodium hydroxide and H2SO4. We made sodium sulfate and water, but the net ionic equation for this was hydrogen plus hydroxide makes water. The other chemical reaction that I was looking at, HCl plus sodium hydroxide, that's a different reagent. And yet its net ionic was hydrogen plus hydroxide equals water. They have the same net ionic equation, because what is happening in solution in a neutralization reaction is hydrogen is reacting with hydroxide to produce water. That is a neutralization reaction. You are neutralizing the hydrogen ion and you are neutralizing the hydroxide and you are producing the neutral water. All neutralizations have the same net ionic equation. They all have the same hydronium plus hydroxide equals water, which is really kind of cool. They are all hydrogen plus hydroxide goes to form water. And we'll put it in here, aqueous and liquid. I'm letting that sink in for a second.
Thank you.
So all neutralization reactions have the same net ionic equation. They are all hydrogen ion plus hydroxide equals water. Jenny, why does 2 sodiums and 2 sulfate Jenny, I don't think you finished that question there. You said 2 sodiums aqueous and a sulfate aqueous, but you didn't say what they're becoming. Or you said why does, but then there was nothing after the why does. Why does 2 sodiums go with a sulfate? Yeah, okay. It's about the charges. So when you're looking at the charges, if I blow that piece up, sodium is a +1 cation and sulfate is a 2-. So it takes 2 sodiums to be able to combine with the sulfate in order to be able to make the ionic formula. So it, yes, it comes down to the ionic formula and how they combine. Notice how everything is building on itself. Notice that we started with the periodic table. Actually, we didn't even start with the periodic table. Notice that we started with the picture of the atom and what's in the inside, the nucleus and the electrons and the charges on the nucleus, on the protons and the electrons. And we started with neutral elements. And then we built out from that and we started looking at what happens if we lose an electron and we created ions. Then we looked at how the ions started balancing with each other in order to form ionic formulas for ionic compounds before we started to get to sharing of things, sharing of electrons. And now we're using those ionic formulas constantly as we learned about polyatomic ions and nomenclature. And now we're putting it together for acid-base reactions. We've done it for double displacement reactions and solubility, that all of the skill sets keep adding on top of each other. And we're going to see that as we proceed into the next chapter, into chapter 8, that we're going to look at putting numbers back to everything again. So we're going through all this chemistry, and we're going to launch into the stoichiometry of taking these balanced chemical equations, and how do I calculate for a balanced chemical equation how much product I'm going to get, or how much reactant I'm going to need. And if I combine two different reactants, which reactant will I run out of first? And how much product can I make if I run out of one of the reactants first? All of these different questions are going to be placed to the chemical equations once we understand these chemical equations, which is kind of cool and big picture-esque in where we're going. So yeah, all of the skill sets keep adding on to each other, which is part of chemistry. And actually, it's nice to do it in the summer because it's so rapid in the summer that all these concepts are on top of each other, and it makes it a little bit easier to recognize them and see the continuum of it. Whereas on a 16-week semester, what happened 5-6 weeks ago, I forgot that. That thing is gone. We took that test in the beginning of the semester, and that material, I brain dumped it, and it's gone, and it ain't ever coming back. Sometimes the semester is longer and more difficult and more challenging in some ways. Okay. This is the end of what I want to do with acid and base. And we've got 10 minutes in the class. What we go into next is redox. And I could give a preview for redox. And I think I'd like to, but I'd like to open it up to questions on acid and base before I ever do anything or launch into something different. So I want to say, and I don't expect you to be perfect on this. I don't expect you to understand or be solid on acid-base either. It all takes practice. Remember the ups and downs. Remember we've talked about that. You get everything under control. You feel good. The nomenclature worksheets, by the way, are looking really good for most people. So I'm feeling like most people really got nomenclature under control and they're all feeling pretty good. And then I bring it acid and base and everybody gets demoralized.
Yeah.
But you'll come back up. You have to trust me. You've always come back up before. You'll come back up again. It'll be okay.
Okay.
Those 10 reactions that we're supposed to write out, when are those due?
Oh, I didn't put a due date on it, but I don't know, in the next day or two, but I need to put a link on Canvas for you to upload them.
What 10 reactions?
From the lab that we were doing with the, when we did the double displacement reactions, and I said, pick 10 of the double displacements that gave products, that gave precipitates, and write out the complete chemical, the ionic and the net ionic.
Oh, I don't remember that, but that's okay.
It's okay. I'll put it into Canvas and I'll put instructions. I'll put clear instructions there.
Thank you.
Yeah. That'll help keep everybody focused. Eric included.
I have a question. So if we're not feeling super great about this yet, do you have homework for us?
Yes. Coming up quickly.
Cool.
Tonight.
Awesome.
With an answer key.
Oh, that's great.
Next question. Maybe not. Maybe you guys are still processing. I'm not going to say good on this. I'm going to say still processing. So yeah. That's okay. That's fair. Still processing. Okay. Let me give you an idea of where we're going. Just to sort of put things in context. What we did with double displacement in the double displacement, so this is just review. You can write this down if you want, but double displacement. These were precipitation reactions. What I did is I took the cation and anion and I swapped the partners. So I traded cation and anion. So I swapped partners, A, B, plus C, D, goes to form A, D, plus C, B. So I traded cation and anion. Now I've taken a look at acid base. In acid base, I traded a proton. Such that the acid gave the proton to the base. And I produced ions, but I'll write it that way. That was an acid base and that we were trading protons. So we went from trading complete ions, cations and anions, and trading them, to trading just the hydrogen ion. In redox, which stands for oxidation reduction, we trade electrons. And so we are following this progression in the book, which is kind of a nice progression of starting by trading ions, trading a hydrogen ion for acid base, and then trading electrons for oxidation and reduction. And this one is harder to write in terms of how I actually write it out. But these reactions are going to be things like this, where I take sodium as a metal and chloride as the element chlorine, and they react to form sodium chloride, now the cation and the anion. So they were neutral to begin with. They had equal numbers of protons and neutrons, and they have traded an electron between the two of them. This is what we call a redox reaction, where we trade electrons. And this is where we get the creation of the ions and creation of polyatomics and things that have charges on them. We could get those also in the acid-base reaction. So that's one place where we can get many of these different ions. But redox reactions is another place where we can create ions. And it has to do with trading electrons. For instance, in this case, what sodium has done as a metal, sodium has given up an electron to become a plus one cation. And chloride, what chloride has done is chloride has gained two electrons to become two Cl minuses, where it now has two extra electrons. And if I take and I multiply the top equation by two, and then I add the two equations together, the number of electrons will cancel out. So what I'll do is I'll multiply the top by two this way. Two sodiums, two sodium ions, two electrons. Now the electrons on either side of the arrows cancel. And when I add the equations together, I see that two sodiums react with Cl2 to produce sodium chloride. And two electrons have been traded. Sodium gave up two. Chlorine took the two. And that's what I call a redox reaction, an oxidation reduction reaction. We'll go into them tomorrow and we'll do the language. We'll define all the terms. We'll look at how the electrons are traded, and we'll map out the equations and how to write all the equations, and how to tell the difference between double displacement, acid base, and redox by looking at the equation and telling what's actually happening. So that's just sort of a preview of where we're going to go tomorrow. And I will work on getting some homework up. Okay. So this is just a comparison, just to show sort of the progression in the way that we're doing things. Trading ions, trading hydrogen ions, trading electrons. Some of the three major types of equations, or the three major types of chemical reactions that we see, that we study in Gen Chem. And almost everything fits into these categories, one of these three categories, which is kind of cool. I have stunned silence.
Yep.
It's okay. Hang on to it. It'll get better. It will. I promise. It'll get better. Plus, we're going to have some labs on the redox stuff. So tomorrow's lab, tomorrow morning, I think when we come in, we'll do a lab on redox and we'll start to make more sense out of it. And or actually tomorrow, what I'll do is I'll do the acid base lab. I'll hold off on the redox one. I'll let us do the redox in lecture, and then we'll do the redox lab after we do that, and it'll make more sense, and we'll get some practice and do it that way. And that way we'll also make more sense out of the acid base stuff. See, I can teach. I know what I'm doing. There's something here. I've got a little bit of something in the tank. I can do this. All right. That's enough.
Can I ask a semi-unrelated question?
Semi-unrelated. Sure. Go for it.
You don't teach Chem 1A during the fall semester.
I don't.
He doesn't.
Can we request that you do?
There are great teachers. There are other great teachers at Cabrillo. I am one of many.
What if we just don't want to know them?
What if we just want to stick with you?
That's true. Okay. That's very humbling. I very much appreciate that. I don't know. The thing is we have our niche areas where we like to teach. And it's not to say that I wouldn't like to teach Chem 1A or Chem 1B. I think that would be totally awesome. But getting the Chem 1A and Chem 1B teachers out of there to teach other things, that's really hard. They're kind of like entrenched and fixed in what they do. And I wouldn't mind teaching 1A or 1B, but it's just always been that Chem 3 and Chem 12, the high and the low. I've got my cheerleaders and my pom-poms on when I'm doing Chem 3. And when I'm doing Chem 12, it is the same.
Ridiculing and punitive and
yeah. No, it's I teach Chem. You know what? I don't change the way I teach, no matter what it is I teach. I teach the same way, in the exact same way. I teach with trust. I teach with encouragement. I teach with knowledge of when you are going to be up and when you are going to be down. I think that it's important, just like a doctor telling you this is going to hurt, be prepared. Makes it a little bit easier sometimes. And all of that is just kind of the way that I like to teach. So I appreciate that you guys are enjoying it, and thank you for the kind words. And I'm sorry.
So are we done?
Yeah, we're done. We're good. Sorry, I'm just rambling. We're done. You can go. I'm not going to do any more chemistry. That might have been too much. She may not have enjoyed the way I teach as much. That's okay. I don't know.
Maybe that's not. Fine.
She may have had an appointment.
Yeah,
I don't take anything personally. All right. Thanks, you guys. Let's call it a day. Let's go get some lunch.
Wait, I have a question.
Wait, okay, quick.
Thank you, sir.
It's not chemistry. It's never chemistry.
Okay.
So I like emailed the chem teachers, the chem teacher in the fall and the physics teacher. And the chem teacher is like, it's the lady.
Yes, Sarah Gerhardt.
Sarah Gerhardt. And so all of the classes like filled up really fast.
Okay.
And I'm waitlisted, and I would hate to not continue. Like, I wouldn't want to like skip a semester.
Right.
Of chem.
Right.
And so I'm just like, thinking of worst possible scenario. and like, what if I can't get in? Do you have any other like community colleges that you would recommend taking chem at if I couldn't get into those classes?
MPC.
What's that?
Monterey Peninsula College.
Okay.
So yes, I know all of the chemistry instructors at all of the different community colleges.
Of course.
I went to school with most of them. Nice. Out of all of them, I think that the teachers at MPC are good. I think that they are very good teachers. I think that they're kind. I think that they're considerate. And I think that they have a good program. And so out of those, my highest recommendation would be Monterey Peninsula College to give that a shot. And I think Frank Rivera probably teaches the Chem 1A. I think it's Frank. They take turns a little bit more over at MPC. And Frank's awesome.
Okay.
People really very much enjoy his class.
Okay, cool.
And so, but I would recommend anybody over there at MPC. I think that they're all fantastic.
Okay, thank you. Because I figure, you know, it's all online, so.
So you can take it anywhere, it doesn't matter.
Take it anywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know, what number on the wait list are you?
5.
You should get in.
One would hope, but she said that I'll either get an email from Cabrillo or she'll email me the day before if anyone drops. So I don't know. I was like, oh, okay. I don't know.
Yeah. So Sarah and Josh, like I said, we all have our personalities. Sarah Gerhardt and Josh Blaustein are two that hold very tight to the rules. And so they have very tight deadlines in terms of turning things in.
Mm-hmm.
They have very strict, like Josh, for instance, if you come in 10 minutes late and you want to turn in your homework, he won't accept it.
Not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. He's just not going to take it. And you're not going to convince him otherwise. And Sarah is maybe not quite as hard, but similar, but they both have, you know, while that may be looked at as a negative, they both have extremely solid, positive aspects. Josh has a fantastic sense of humor. He is one of the most brilliant, witty people that I know in terms of humor. His humor is dry. You have to appreciate it, but he's quick and he's very funny. And Sarah is just as enthusiastic and bubbly as she can be in terms of teaching. She wants you to understand the material and she's very enthusiastic when she presents it. And so there's a tremendous amount to learn from both of them. And I think that they're both exciting teachers and good teachers, very solid teachers.
I'd love to take them, but I don't want to.
To get blocked out.
To get blocked out.
Yeah, for sure. So MPC would be my best recommendation.
Okay.
I would stay away from Gavilan.
Okay.
And Hartnell, I would probably stay away from Hartnell. As much as I should not say this on camera, I'm going to delete this later.
That's fine. You delete it. It's all good.
San Jose City College might be good.
Okay.
I don't know who their Chem 1A teacher is at San Jose City College, but they generally run a pretty good program too.
Okay. And then my final question was, I know how you, like, I see how everything's building and that's lovely. But if you're not feeling like you're fully understanding everything, then you're building on a very shaky foundation and that's problematic, right?
Your foundation building is always behind where I'm lecturing. It's okay. Don't panic.
So just, okay. I'm just
keep going with it.
All right, cool. I'm just going to
just roll with it.
Okay, cool. I will. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. We'll try and make it better. We'll try and give you enough work and assignments and things to solidify and practice the skill sets, because it all comes down to practice. The reason you're feeling shaky is because you're trying to base your comprehension on watching a lecture, and you can't do that. You have to base your comprehension on multiple iterations of study and practice.
Oh, totally. And I'm doing all the practicing, but I want to be really solid.
Okay. All right.
I'm not breaking out.
No, but you're on it. You're doing all the right things. So you're doing all the right things.
Okay. Okay, thank you. I'll see you tomorrow.
Okay, see you tomorrow.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, you guys, I'm going to end the session unless there's any questions here.